This will be a tape recording of a talk given by Linda Metzler of Dixon, California. This talk was given to the 6th Annual Yosemite AA Summit Conference, held at the Curry Pavilion in Yosemite National Park on Saturday, November the 11th, 1989. At the time of this talk, Linda Metzler had been sober over 8 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. This tape was produced in the spirit of AA's 12th step to carry this message, and members of the fellowship should bear in mind AA's tradition number 11 regarding anonymity at the level of press, radio, TV, and films in their use of this tape.
Linda, that's about all I know, so I can't say too much. So without anything else, Linda.
Hi, everybody. I'm Linda, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, it's really good to be here. Thank you, Don. And I want to, first up, to thank the committee for having me here to share with you what has been so freely given to me in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there are people out here that know me today, so I guess that means I have to tell the whole truth and the truth. And I also want to acknowledge my husband who's here with me today. And if you're new, you know, we're going to form a relationship here in the next hour, and it's going to be really good because it's only going to last about an hour. Anyway, if you don't understand that, keep coming back. But I am here with my husband, and he is my friend and my sweetheart. And my knight in shining armor. And what he is not is he's not my God, which is good. And it's necessary for me to be sober in this program. I am his sobriety goddess, though. I do want to tell you that. but that's my husband, Ken, over here. And he's got the cowboy hat on. And I'm here with him. And I'm really grateful to share my journey with my husband. I always like to start out with a couple little stories because it helps you guys not be so nervous. Boy, I need Al-Anon, don't I know? And are there any people here just in their first 30 days, could you raise your hand or stand up or do something? Shaking your chairs, you probably already are doing that. All right. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Hold on to your seats. You're in for the most wonderful journey you could ever possibly imagine. The first conference I went to out of town, I remember a man said that the most important person in the room is sitting in your seat, and I was sitting on somebody's lap. And I said, oh my God, story of my life. But, you know, to the new people, we need you. We need you so very much. And please keep coming back. I have this little story I want to share with you. A lady went to, I always tell this and some people have heard it, but I don't care. I'm going to tell it because I like it. This lady wanted a talking parrot, and she went to a pet store, and she said, I want to have a talking bird, and it's got to be a female. And the guy said, oh, I've got just the thing for you. And she'd been praying, right, for this bird, to find this right bird. And so she bought this talking bird. And she took it home and she put it in this cute little ornate cage she had bought. And the minute somebody came into her house, the bird talked. And what this little female parrot said was, hi, baby, I'm a swinger. Want to have a good time? And the lady went, oh, my God, I can't have this. And so she tried everything she knew to get this bird to stop doing that, but she just wouldn't stop, so she took it back to the pet store, and she said, you just can't believe what this bird does every time somebody walks through the door. It says, hi, baby, I'm a swinger. Want to have a good time? She says, I just can't have this. So a man happened to be standing there, and he overheard her plight, and he came over, and he said, you know, excuse me, he says, but I heard you telling this problem of yours, and I just happen to have two male parrots at home, and all day long, all they do is sit in the corner praying over these little bees. And he says, you know, there's obviously spiritual birds. I'm sure that if you brought your wayward female parrot over, that they could just fix her right up. And this lady said, and this is kind of be careful what you pray for. She said, oh, I would pray, thank you, God. So she took her bird over to the man's house and took the bird and plopped it in the cage. And there's the guys over there in the corner, and they're praying away. And no sooner did the little female parrot get on the perch, and she said, hi, baby, I'm a swinger. Want to have a good time? And one male parrot said to the other, put the beads away, George, our prayers have been answered. My kind of story. The other little thing I want to share with you is a man went to the doctor for a checkup, and afterwards the doctor said, well, come into my office. And boy, I don't, if you're Al-Anon, maybe you should like leave the room for this one. I have an Al-Anon sponsor, so she told me I could tell it. But anyway, this guy goes to the doctor, he gets a physical. The doctor says, well, get dressed and come see me in my office. And he says, well, I've got some bad news and some advice. And the guy says, well, God, all right, give me the bad news. He says, well, I'm really sorry, but you've only got 6 months to live. And he says, well, what's the advice? He says, well, I want you to run out and marry an Al-Anon. And the guy said, I've only got 6 months to live, and the best you can do is tell me to run out and marry an Al-Anon. He says, yeah, because it'll be the longest 6 months you've ever lived. I can feel all the Al-Anons releasing me now. Let go. Let Linda. No, I'm kidding. You know, the first time you tell a story like that, you kind of go, I can't believe I have the nerve to say that. But then once you tell it a few times, you get to where you really like it. Anyway, I am really grateful to be here, especially if you're new. You know, you'll hear around the program, you'll hear people say that they are grateful alcoholics, and I didn't understand what that meant when I came to you, but I really feel that today with everything that's inside of me. It is, it's my prayer that all of us will stay here and keep coming back and work the steps of this program, because I don't believe that for a minute that a seat in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous guarantees me sobriety. What it guarantees me from what I have learned here is that it guarantees me a seat in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous for the time that I'm in there. And that it is through the steps and my God as I understand him that I have found recovery. And it is my prayer that we all stay, so that we are here to offer to the new person when they come through the door the same thing that was offered to me the moment I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it is, outside of the knowledge that I am an alcoholic, the greatest gift I have ever been given. And that is that we can stay here to keep our hand out to that new person to offer them the gift of hope. If I have found anything in Alcoholics Anonymous through the steps and through all of you, it is hope, because I came to you hopeless and today I'm hopeful, and I came to you faithless and today I am faithful. I was back east at a conference last year. Ken and I had the opportunity to go back there to Maryland, and it was really quite an experience. Got to share at a conference back there, God, you know, the neatest thing about being sober, one of the neatest things about, there's so many neat things, but one of the great things about being sober in Alcoholics Anonymous is that wherever we go, we are home. We don't ever have to be alone again. We don't ever have to be alone again. And that's so wonderful. And we can go, you know, 3,000 miles across the United States and we find people just like us. And the really wonderful thing is if somebody had told me 10 years ago that 10 years from now, Linda, you're going to get asked to go, you know, back east, and you're going to fly 3,000 miles, and you're going to get to an airport you've never been to before, and you're going to stand there and wait for someone you've never met in your entire life, and you're going to trust them enough to get in a car with them and go for a couple hours, you know, here and there, and put your life in their hands. And I wouldn't have believed that for a minute. And the instant bonding that we do here, that this power that takes place between one alcoholic to another, it is a power greater than ourselves. It just is. And it's really quite an experience. And if you're new, don't miss it. Please don't miss it. Anyway, this man back east that shared at the conference, he said, Indian Don, and I like what he said, He said, well, if you think you were brought up in a dysfunctional family, you're probably right because you were there. And I have never heard it put more simply and more clearly than all this junk we get into around the program. And he just said it all right there. But I am the youngest of four children. I'm the baby of the family. And I always like to say that when babies come out, they come out crying. And I came out saying, I'm sorry, and I'll never do it again, I promise. And, you know, for me, I stayed sorry for a long, long time. And everything was my fault. But at 12 years old, when I took my first drink, oh, something wonderful happened. It became your fault. And I liked it much better. I grew up a very overweight little girl, and my sister, Karen, who's the oldest, she was absolutely gorgeous. She was in the Miss California contest or something, I don't know. She was beautiful. And the common remark when I would be introduced was, she'd say, and this is my baby sister Linda, and people, their common remark would be, that's your sister? You know, and I didn't have any tools to deal with comments like that. And it was pretty tough. In the fourth grade, a little boy named Ricky nicknamed me Linda Lump. Oh my God. That was worth a lot of drinks later, let me tell you. And I sort of went through life feeling like Linda Lump. My family started calling me Linda Lump. My teachers called me Lumpy. I mean, I just thought I'll never go out of this image. At 12 years old, when I took my first drink, you know, I've heard it said around here that I don't know if I was born an alcoholic, but I do know that when I took that first drink, an alcoholic was born. And it was just what I had been waiting for. I found out later when I came to you that I drank for effect. And it was the effect, that first drink, which is where we all started, that I became that maid of California right there, right then, when I took that drink. And I didn't know that then, but I chased that illusion for 17 more years until I came to you. I want to tell you right off the bat, because sometimes I forget, not because I don't have one, because I do have a sobriety date. Last Friday, I was 9 years sober. I celebrated my birthday, and I came to you in January of 1980. And for all of you who are new and may have the idea that we do this through prayer and medication. It was pointed out to me that it's prayer and meditation, and I remember being in a coffee shop after I got sober. A lady from Sacramento who'd been sober a long time, I thought I was pretty fly. I had these two little yellow Valiums in my coin purse just in case the steps didn't work. I was going to be ready, you know. And she leaned over to me and she said, you know, honey, I don't know about you, but my body doesn't know the difference between a drink and a Valium. A Valium just might be the driest martini your body's ever had. She said, so flush them down the toilet. I said, oh, I'll do it when I get home. She said, oh, we'll go in the bathroom right now. And I did what she told me, and I'm grateful that she gave me that piece of information because my head is very clear today. I make very conscious, sober decisions today. And it's because of the truth you have been willing to tell me in my sobriety. And if you're new, I hope that you can get a grasp on that kind of foundation in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. A man told me early in my sobriety, he said, if somebody around here tells you it's okay to do marijuana maintenance, chances are 6 months from now they won't be in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, so remember that. And that's what I pass on to people. And generally what we're given is what we give away. And I want to say, too, you know, the last time that I spoke at a speaker meeting, I shared that, you know, I know that there are a lot of other programs that help us. But I want to tell you, I was in a meeting not too long ago, and I'm real clear in myself from what my sponsor has taught me about my responsibility to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not get a watered-down message of AA when I came here in 1980. When I walked into my first meeting, what I heard was the Big Book and the Steps. And I know there are a lot of other programs, but you know, I have watched newcomers walk out of meetings and not know what kind of meeting they were in because there was so much distortion in the meeting of so many other programs. And the person is sitting there just trying to find out how to not drink today, and their very life is on the line. And I feel for me as a recovering alcoholic, I have a responsibility to give them exactly what was given to me. And to me, I think it's really important. And I know for some people that makes some people uncomfortable. But I was in a meeting not too long ago and a lady raised her hand and said, I'm so-and-so, I'm cross-addicted. I thought, my God, she's addicted to religious artifacts. You know, I don't know what was wrong with her. Like my and my sponsor taught me from the beginning, you've been different all your life. Come in here, take a seat, and be one among many. You're an alcoholic. And that's why I call myself an alcoholic, because I am. But by the time I was 16, I was a very smart girl, very bright, high IQ. Too smart for my own good, probably. I've heard around here that some people can be nobody's too stupid to get this program, but you can be too smart. When I told my first sponsor that I graduated from high school when I was 16 years old, I had been accelerated. I was very smart. She said, yeah, you know, well, a lot of people come to AA with degrees, but, you know, a thermometer has degrees on it. You know what they do with that, don't you? God. She was starting to be mean to me. I'm sensitive. I hurt easy, and I don't do pain well. At 19, I moved out and I moved into an apartment with some girls and they were alcoholics. We attract what we are. Oh, I hated that when I first got here when I heard that. And a man popped his head over the fence one day from his patio and he said, I was 19 years old and he said, would you like a drink? And I said, sure. It was pretty easy to get back in my life then. And the other thing is that I had so many impossibilities in my life, I cannot even name them all. It was impossible, I thought, that as smart as I was to have a loving relationship, it was impossible to have a career. It was impossible to be serene. From the time I remember my earliest feelings, from the time I was a little girl, I was afraid, and I don't know where it came from, but I know that it was there. And until I came to you, I just was just certain I was going to live about like that till I died. And I was probably going to die behind all of my fear. But what happened for me was that day that I met this man, he said, well, he offered me a drink, and then he said, well, I've got to go to the store and buy the stuff. And I remember, my instant thought was, gee, you think if you offered someone a drink, you'd have it right here, right now. But I waited, and he came back, and I can't share with you a lot of what happened that night because I don't remember. That was the beginning of blackout for me. But I do remember exactly what the book talks about, what I experienced at 19 years old in that man's bedroom at 3 a.m. was I came to and I looked around and it was obvious to me what had taken place in the room and I felt what the book talks about, the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization that we have all experienced, every single one of us. And I gathered myself together and I snuck out. So by the time I got from that room to the front door, I had also done another thing that the book talks about. I had justified it all. And the next morning I was back down at his door, or that morning, knocking on the door, and when he opened it I said, but you don't understand, I'm not really like that. And my sponsor, who is still my sponsor to this day, said to me, well, what are you like, Linda? There's a part in the book that says we judge ourselves by our intentions while the world judges us by our actions. You either are or you are not. You are what you do. And I was told when I got sober, we got to talk the talk before we can walk the walk. But it's the walking that makes a difference in my sobriety as to whether I'm living this program. The man must have believed me because some months later we got married. He was an alcoholic. We spent the next 10 years in just utter insanity. And it doesn't get better. His mother died shortly after we got married, and he seemed to handle it really well. He had vodka in the Catholic religion, and I thought I had the vodka. I thought it was the Catholic religion I was missing, but maybe that was why I didn't walk through it so well. But I could not deal with my own mortality. I had so many fears. It was about this time when she died that I started hyperventilating a lot and having what they called anxiety attacks, panic attacks. I became agoraphobic. All these little labels that they put on me from all when I went to find out what was wrong with me. I started calling my own ambulance. Somebody had to do it. My family would just kind of look at me like, not again. I would get very scared. I would drink and it wouldn't work, and it would work and then it wouldn't work, and I'd get very afraid and I'd dial 911 and I'd say, I'm dying, come and get me. And I'd hyperventilate so bad that I'd think I was going to have a heart attack, and they'd come and get me, and I'd go to the emergency room, and they'd shoot me up with something or give me something and send me on my way. And I did that for 10 years. 10 years. And I never ever once thought, never entered my mind that I was an alcoholic. I thought that I was a hypochondriac, an agoraphobic, I was a this, I was a that, I was a liar, a cheat, a thief, a woman of loose desires, but I was not an alcoholic. Anything but that. And isn't it nice that the one thing that I did not want to be is a thing today in my life I am the absolute most grateful for to know. I got pregnant with our first child, and I thought that for sure that this would straighten me up. And, you know, by this time my family was saying to me, Linda, get yourself together, Linda, Linda, Linda. And they would say, can't you see what it's doing to you? And I'd think, can't you see what it's doing for me? When I got pregnant with my first baby, I did what every good alcoholic does. I stopped smoking. Because I wanted to have a healthy baby. And at 6 months pregnant, you know, I just would not stop drinking. At 6 months pregnant, I went into labor. I hemorrhaged. I lost 3 pints of blood. I was rushed to the hospital. And I delivered my little baby son in the corner of the room. They didn't even take me to the delivery room. I was so crazy. I was so hysterical. I was just out of my mind. And I was in deep in alcoholism already. And I was the alcoholic in the corner of the room having the baby in my hospital bed. And when my son was born, he was there for about 20 minutes, and of course, he didn't live, and it was an absolute nightmare for me, and it was very painful. And the hardest part about it was, is that I had no tools to deal with the grief, with my part in it, none of it. And they took him away, and I never saw him again. I never participated in his burial. I, to this day, don't know what they did with him. I didn't name him because I didn't have the dignity and the self-respect to do that. They said, you mustn't do that. I said, okay. But in my heart of hearts, that was not what I wanted to do. But I didn't have what it took to stand up and look the world in the eye. Because as an untreated alcoholic, it was an absolute impossibility for me to do that on my own. I couldn't. And on my own power, I could not do those things. And it is only through you and the steps of this program and my God, as I understand him, that I have been able to tap into that source of power to stand up today and walk with dignity and look the world in the eye. After I lost my son, the next 2 years were a real downhill run for me. I spent the next couple of years locked up in my house pretty much drinking, or when I would go out, I would drink to get there. I would drink when I got there. And I was 2 years later, you know, you've taught me the difference here between grief and self-pity. You know, and we walk through things and we're human. We cry. We feel. Thank God we can do those things today. But, you know, 2 years later, sitting in my son's room with it half put together with the little baby curtains in the crib, putting a baby bonnet on the dog, drinking wine, just in oblivion, was complete self-pity and untreated alcoholism. And I got pregnant again because I thought that maybe if I did that, I would be all right. And also by this time I had started going outside of my marriage. I found that, you know, when I was here, I wanted to be over there, and when I got over there, I wanted to be over there, and when I got over there, it wasn't okay, and I had to go someplace else. And it was always people, places, and things that I wanted to fix me, and I used a lot of people on the way. I got pregnant again, and during that time, you know, again, I quit smoking, but I didn't quit drinking. And when I was 6.5 months pregnant, my son was born. He weighed 3 pounds. They put him in a high-risk infant unit, and I would go see him every day in between drinks. And, you know, sometimes I look back, and I don't know at that time without the program. Maybe that was all I had to get me through it. I really don't know. But, you know, everybody thought that maybe this will straighten Linda out. But my son came home, and I thought, oh, my God, you know, now I've got a purpose in life. And for about the first 6 months, it worked real well. But, you know, in the ABCs at the end of How It Works, where it says that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives, that probably no human power could relieve us of our alcoholism, that God could and would if he were sought. And so not even my little precious baby son that I struggled so hard to have could relieve me of my alcoholism. And I was right back out there doing it all over again. Only this time I had more people in my life to hurt. And as I was cheating on my husband and doing all these things, I started having some dreams about working in law enforcement. So what I told myself was, is if I hung out with a lot of cops, maybe I could be one. Just like when I came into AA and I thought, if I just sit by you, I'll get it. If I just touch you, something will happen for me. And I found here that, you know, that works for a while, but sooner or later, nobody rides for free, and I have to work for it. In all the cheating that I did on my husband, it got pretty crazy. And one night I was coming home and I got a policeman stopped me and gave me a ticket, and he flirted with me and I flirted with him, and I had no boundaries back then. It was so easy to get into my life. I would do anything for you to love me, for you to care about me. And later in sobriety, I almost lost my life behind wanting someone to love me rather than surrender to the simple program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I started a relationship with that man, and he was married, and that didn't matter to me back then. I didn't have the kind of dignity and self-respect. My sponsor told me when I got sober, because I was the kind of woman that looked around the meetings and said, well, he looks pretty good. Well, he's married. Well, I can get around that. And my sponsor told me, you know, with all the respect that she walks with in her life, she said, if you cannot practice these principles in all of your affairs, then do not have affairs. And what she was telling me simply was, Linda, this is an honest program. It is a program of rigorous honesty. And, you know, not too long ago, I heard of a, you know, well, anyway, I'm not going to share it. But anyway, it's you know, I have learned that here, that I don't have to live like that anymore. You know, I don't need to do that. I'm as free as I want to be within the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that means that I don't have to lie, cheat, or steal on my husband. I don't have to do that, and I don't. And that feels really good today for this alcoholic, coming from where I came from. It's good news for him, too, huh? He already knows that. And to the man in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I am so grateful to you. You have, well, I don't know all of you personally, and I'm glad I could say that today anyway. She said, yeah, there's a lot of people here. Let me tell you, back then, who was counting? It wasn't until I did my fourth step I said, my God! Anyway, I guess that's why they have you put it on paper. But the men in the program, you have taught me about selling myself out sober and about not selling myself out sober. And I'm very grateful to you. You have told me the truth, and you have taught me how to be friends with you. And I thank you for that. You have really helped this woman with her self-respect, and I appreciate it. I bet none of you guys ever heard that before. But, you know, I value the men in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that a lot of women get sober and they hang out in women's meetings, but I know that when we read in the beginning that Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they, and on and on. And so I want your experience too, as much as the women in this program. And the women in the program, God bless you, because you have loved me enough to tell me the truth, even when I have not wanted to hear it. Most of the time I have not wanted to hear it, but you've told me anyway. And your experience has taught me so much about myself, because you know the female experience. You know that. And it just works so well here together between us, doesn't it? But anyway, when I started to cheat on my husband, and I got involved with this policeman, and before I knew it, we were about 10 months down the road. He told me his wife was pregnant, and I said, well, I've got to just leave you alone because I've got some class. And but I went right out and found me another cop to hang out with. You know, what they represented to me, and I wanted to be one, and what they represented to me was all the strength and all the toughness and all the, they weren't afraid, and I was consumed by fear. So I had to hang out with somebody who didn't have any fear. And I had long since stopped being any kind of mother. I was dumping my son off on whoever would take him, and I was usually not very picky. And I pulled up to a corner one day, and there was about 8 motor officers on a corner. And, you know, all in their helmets and broom mustaches and motorcycles and guns, and they all looked the same to me. And he was pretty well. And I pulled up and I said, "Hey, have you seen so-and-so?" And a guy got off his motorcycle and he walked over to me like John Wayne, you know, and he said, "No, but will I do?" And I said, "Sure, you'll do." And that started, you know, the most terrifying, degrading, humiliating, pitiful time of my life. But it is what led me to you. And and that's why I don't regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. Because everything that has happened led me right to where I'm standing right now at 9 years sober, pretty comfortable in my own skin today. But I started that situation with him, and it was insanity. He was a crazy alcoholic, and so was I. But you see, I was pointing the finger at him, and which I was really good at. And I didn't think that I had the problem. And we went through a lot of crazy, insane things together, and I decided to apply for the Sacramento Police Department, and I did. I took the written and I passed it. But you know, I was told when I got here that showing up is 98% of this program. Not just showing up to take a seat in a meeting, showing up to put our eyes in the big book, showing up to put our finger in the phone to call our sponsors, showing up to take people to meetings. But they scheduled a physical agility test the morning after my 28th birthday party. And I was so angry when I got that notice. I thought, in fact, it was my 29th birthday party. It was right before I came to the program. And I said, "My God, who do they think they are?" So I called them and asked them to change the test. They said, "No, we're not going to do that for you." And I stayed up all night. I had tons of people in my house, most of whom I did not know. That was pretty normal for me back then. I was living in a house I couldn't afford, driving a car I couldn't afford because I didn't have a job. I did not know how to be self-supporting through my own contributions. I was letting the man I had been married to, who I was still not divorced from yet, take care of me financially because I deserved it. I remember calling my sponsor one night after I got sober. I'd been sober a while, and I said, "Well, I'm doing all this stuff around the program. What am I going to get with what I want? What am I going to get what I deserve?" And I heard, this real calm sponsoring voice say, "Linda, if you got everything you deserved, honey, you wouldn't be here." Being mean to me again, but that morning I remember another behavior that took place for me in my living room with all these people there, and we had been up all night drinking, and I weighed about 190 pounds at this time, and they said, "Come on, Linda, we'll take you over there, we'll shove you over the 6-foot fence," and I signed it on, and I said, "No big deal, it doesn't matter to me, see, I don't care, I don't need to do that, I really don't want to do it anyway, I'd die to look good for you. Die to look good for you." But in here, it killed me because I gave it up. I gave it all up for a feeling, all of it. I let it all go by me. And I gave in to the fact, the prospect in my mind, that, see, there's another impossibility. I just can't do anything. So I didn't show up. And, of course, if you don't show up, you can't pass. And I let go of another dream that I had of mine because the drink came first. And it was curious to me. I found out after I got sober that I thought it was about the 10th drink that got me drunk, and my sponsor said, "No, it's the first drink, and if you don't take it, you can't get drunk." I thought, what a simple concept that is. down the line with this policeman, one night off duty, he got in a wreck on his own motorcycle, and he was quite an officer. He had been, he was a bachelor. He had been, just the challenge I wanted, had never been married, and didn't like kids or any of that stuff, and he went around a corner one night on his own motorcycle and hit a parked car, and his brains ended up on the pavement. But he didn't die. And they took him to a hospital, and he was so severely injured that they took him to another hospital, and he had brain surgery. He was in a coma for 2 months. Now, I was still with my husband. I was running back and forth doing all this stuff, just leading an absolute insane life. And he finally came out of his coma, and I was the one that took him home from the hospital. And I'll never forget this. Even then, in all my alcoholism, in all my denial, we walked in the front door of his house. He couldn't even remember his first name half the time. He was never the same after this. And He walked in the front door of his house, and he thought he was in Bakersfield sometimes, but he was in Sacramento. And he walked in the door of his house, and he said, "I got to go in the kitchen and make myself a drink." You see, alcoholism is what it says. Alcohol. In that statement in the book, remember, we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. Somebody asked me once, what is the most important word in that sentence? And I said, alcohol. And they said, no, remember. Because it's cunning, baffling, and powerful. And after the coma and all that stuff, his disease just didn't give up. It was still right there, and it picked up right where he left off. As we got more and more insane and things got really crazy, I used to, by this time I had moved up the street by this man, and I used to drag my little boy down there. I'd say, "Eddie, come on, we're going to go down the street." And he'd say, "Mommy, I don't want to go." And the reason he didn't want to go was because he knew that I was going to leave him standing out on the corner. Well, I went into this man's house and made myself comfortable. In all my self-centeredness and selfishness, I could never lift myself out of me. I had to have help. And I would drag my little boy down there. I can just picture it in my mind, pulling him, just not wanting to go, and me just dragging him down there. And then we'd get in front of that house, and he'd say, "Mommy, I want to come in." And I'd say, "No, Eddie, you wait out here. Mommy will be out in a few minutes." And you know when an alcoholic tells you that, you could be out there 3 weeks. And I went into this house. I can't even call it a home. It was an alcoholic's house. And all the curtains were always drawn. And it was dirty. And it was just in disarray. And his room, his bedroom, the walls were all painted black. And it was dirty. And on one wall of the room was a sign that said, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil, for I am the meanest son of a bitch in the valley." Those are the kind of people I wanted to be with, rather than my little boy. And I went in that bedroom that day, and I drank. And I drank. And the man passed out. There was a knock at the door, and I went, and my son was standing there crying, and he said, "Mommy, please let me in." And I said, "No, Eddie, I'll be out in a little while." And I shut the door, and a little while later, when I was laying on the bed and the curtains were pulled, and I heard this uncontrollable crying, and I went to the window, and I pulled the curtain back, and I saw my 5-year-old little boy standing on the corner leaning against the street sign with his face in his hands, crying uncontrollably. And it was for me like what the book talks about, that out there in our drinking we all get a moment of clarity. And that was my moment of clarity. That I looked at my son, and I looked back at the room and the black walls and the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization and the man in the bed and the bottles and the filth and the disgust. And for the first time, I saw myself as I really was. But I knew I couldn't do anything to change it. And I let the curtain go. And I let that curtain go time and time and time again. Until I came to you and you taught me how to live differently. I can't do this without you. I just can't. I didn't leave my son standing out there forever, but that was the way he lived. And I know that a lot of times when we come in the program, we say, "Well, I only hurt myself when I was out there drinking." I don't believe that for a minute. Statistically, they say, and you know, we don't deal too much in statistics, but I've heard it said that the alcoholic hurts 7 people in their drinking. I think it's more like about 30 at least. But one night this man took a lot of pills, and he was crazy. And he had a motor officer partner, and they retired him. He was never the same from his accident, but he was full into his drinking again, and he had taken a bunch of pills one night. And I want to share with you, too, my relationship with my family, such as my mother and father and my brothers and sisters, was awful. I was the one, I had become the person who never showed up. I was the one you couldn't depend on. I was the one you couldn't count on. You know, if they had a get-together, they never asked me to bring anything. Because they were lucky if I even showed up. And when I did, it was always a grand entrance, my ego. But this man had a motor officer partner who, and I will never forget him, who always talked about a man that he knew in AA. And he said, "Maybe we can get him into AA." Well, one night this guy took a bunch of pills and everything, and he was out of his mind, and he called me. And I called this man named Billy, And I said, Billy, you better get your friend from AA to come over here because he's crazy. He's dying. He needs help, as I was drinking right along with him. And by this time, we were into guns and everything. And Billy showed up that night with a man named Bob B., who was from Sacramento at the time, was in the Bay Area now. And Bob B. walked in the door, and he sat down, and he put his hand down, and he shook my friend's hand, and he looked at me, and he shook my hand. And what I saw in Bob was what I see, and have seen, ever since that night when Bob walked through that door. And it's what I see when I look out at all of you, every single one of you. And that's I see in your eyes, the sunlight of the Spirit. Because I didn't have it then. And what I saw was a man who was alive and he had hope. And he wanted to live. God, he wanted to live. And he shared his experience, strength, and hope that night. And one of the things I was really impressed with was he didn't repeat himself over and over again. And he would look over at me and I would look at him and I kept thinking, well, he knows I don't have a problem. He's talking to him. And they went to a meeting, and I went and drank. And about 3 o'clock that morning, they came back, and I was waiting around the corner, sneaking around, hiding out, because I didn't need it, you see. When I saw my friend go into the door and Bob drive off, I went up into his house, and I said, well, what was it like? What was it like? He said, oh, well, we went to a meeting, and it was really neat. And now the kind of relationship I had with people out there was not one based on a foundation of trust and honesty and mutual respect. What he said to me was, and there was lots of really pretty women there. And I said, well, I'm going to an AA meeting because none of those women are going to get you. I came here with a purpose. I was a hostage taker, boy. If I met you and we went home together, you were mine. And whether you wanted to be or not, you couldn't even get rid of me after that. So the following Saturday night, I left about 20 people in my house whom I was having over for dinner, spaghetti, and most of them I didn't know. And I drove down to a place called Primary Purpose Group in Sacramento at 12th and I. Now, it was above a Continental bus station. And I remember walking up the stairs. I was late. I was late the first 2 years. Because if the meeting started at 8, I started getting ready about 2 in the afternoon, and I would still always be late. I had to look good, you know, and rather than be on time and welcome the new people. Let someone else do that, I thought. But I remember walking up the stairs, and I'm dying of alcoholism. And I thought, my God, these bus fumes, they must be really bad for you. And all my denial, I thought, how could they have a meeting over a bus station? What about these fumes, you know? And I'm dying of alcoholism. But I went into the meeting and I sat up front because I showed a place where there was a chair. Someone directed me up there and it was kind of on the side and I sat down and people were looking at me. And, you know, my sponsor told me when I got sober, she said, Linda, you look like one of those women that sit at the end of the bar. I said, wait a minute. Who do you think you're talking to? I don't always sit at the end of the bar. I sit in the middle sometimes. Sometimes I even sit at a table. My last New Year's Eve, I was on the table. I was dancing. Anyway, that's true. I was. But all these people were looking at me, and I thought, well, they're looking at me because they know I don't belong here. I am not like any of these people. And after the meeting, about 15 women came up to me and gave me their numbers. And that's a miracle of what happens around here, is that if you're new, we know where you've been. And we know, we really do know how you feel. We have an idea. And the best part is if you trust the people who have been around here a little bit longer than you, we know where you're going to go. and it's good. It's all good. But isn't it something that Bob's wife at the time, because that happens in AA too. I heard a man say once at a speaker meeting that he was going to talk about revolvements, and that he meant relationships, but he said revolvements. I know that I did too good with either one. But something happened that first night. I don't know exactly. I didn't know that night, but it is what I talked about when I first got up here, and that for the first time in years, I had some kind of hope, an inkling of hope. Because I knew the way I was when I came to you that I was going to die if I kept living that way. When I came around PPG in the beginning, they called me Crazy Linda, and I took it as a compliment. Oh, God. I said, yeah, I'm crazy. And they were laughing, I think, with me sometimes. But sometimes I think they were, you know, I remember at 30 days sober, it was a podium meeting, and they'd call for volunteers, and I would just, I would talk about nothing. And I would, they'd call for a volunteer, and I would jump out of my seat, and I'd run up to the podium, and I'd just go on and on and on. And they have this little hooter that after 6 minutes, they want you to sit down and shut up and let someone else talk. But what's a horn? I mean, you know, I had important things to say. And I remember I got up one morning, and I jumped out of my seat when they called for volunteers, and then... And my sponsor was sitting in the front row, and the meeting was packed, and I started talking, and I stuck my finger in my eye, and my mascara got in my eye, and my eyes started running, and so I said, could somebody please give me a Kleenex, and I have one here, and I shoved it up to, somebody gave me one, and I shoved it up to my eye like this, and I kept talking into the microphone, and everybody, you know, they were starting to kind of giggle, and then I got a bloody nose over here, and I said, well, could somebody give me a Kleenex, and somebody did, and I went like this, and I was like this, trying to get to the microphone. And my sponsor was slowly sinking down in her seat. And everyone was laughing, and I said, I'm so funny! This lady named Grady stood up, and when I finally sat down and shut up, and she said, Lori, if you don't want a sponsor, I'll take her. And I thought, she likes me. Oh, my God. Somebody told me about a year later, they said, you know, Grady likes those real sick ones. And I said, oh, that's me. No, you know. But I started going to meetings, and I started, people started telling me the truth about me, and I didn't want to hear it. A man named Dan W. told me, he gave me my first big book, and he said to me something one day about myself that I was just, I was indignant. How could you talk to me like that? And I said that to him, and he said, Linda, I care more about your life than what you think of me. I want you to live. And that's what I do today with you. I care more about your life than what you think of me. We must love each other enough to tell each other the truth, because this is a program of rigorous honesty. My sponsor started working with me, and this man that I came in with didn't stay. Somebody saw him about 6 months ago. He stopped into a meeting for a cup of coffee. He was living in his car. And I don't believe, for me, that I'm chosen by any means because I get to take a seat. It's a privilege to take a seat in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've heard people say that, well, I'm chosen by God, and I started thinking, well, does that mean that the ones who aren't here yet aren't chosen? And I thought, no, you know, my God doesn't work like that. The difference for me between, you know, now and then is that I believe my God loved me just as much out there as he does standing up here today, sober in this program. The difference is because of the steps of this program and because of you, I know it today. See, I didn't know it back then. I know my God loves me today. But I had put another man in my life, you know, because I could not be alone. I did not know how to live with Linda. And in sobriety, I was still calling my own ambulance. I'd go from the meeting straight to the emergency room. And I met a man, and he was an alcoholic. I met him in a bar one night right before I got sober. We exchanged zodiac signs and went home with each other. Didn't take much. And I found out the next day he was 10 years younger than me, and that didn't make a difference. He didn't have a job, a car, or anything, and he didn't want one, and I thought that was just fine. And I started trying to be sober, living with a practicing alcoholic. And the other sort of defect that he had was he was very violent. And I spent the next 2 years of my sobriety living in absolute violence, and 2.5 years, actually, being beat up, bashed around, broken ribs, black eyes, smashed in the face, go into emergency rooms, come into meetings, telling you what he was doing to me. One more time saying, look what the world is doing to me. And you kept telling me, Linda, you got to get honest. You have got to put your sobriety first. You've got to surrender to the simple program or you're going to die. You're not going to make it. And I'd say, but you don't know what you're talking about. They have the problem. He's got the problem. And I just would not surrender. About 6 months into my sobriety, I got a job as a cocktail waitress in the bar that I had drank in because my sponsor told me I should be self-supporting through my own contributions. So I went right out and got a job as a cocktail waitress. And I found out I was trying to live vicariously through the people in the bar. I wasn't drinking, but I wanted to grab all that excitement that I thought was still there for me. And then around, I take my big book to work because I wanted to try to be a humble cocktail waitress. And I would take my big book to work and I would carry it under my tray. And then around about midnight, I'd start trying to 12-step. Nobody wanted any, they weren't interested. But I think so. But, boy, I don't recommend that to anybody. But around 10 months sobriety, I used, and I got exactly what I wanted that day. And I hope I don't ever have to feel like that again because I had about 10 months of AA, and I used some chemicals. And I tried to go to my God, and, boy, let me tell you, it was awful. And a man in a meeting who is no longer alive, but he saw me in the meeting that day, and he knew I was lying through my teeth. He knew I had done something but wasn't talking about it, and he cared enough to confront me. And I'm so grateful that he did. Because on a street corner after a meeting, he said, Linda, did you drink? And I said, no. And I walked away. And he said, come back here. Did you use? And I fell apart. I fell into his arms and I cried. And I said, yes, but I'm not telling anybody. He goes, you just told me. Now go to a meeting and get honest. And he was one of the men that taught me about being friends. Said he wanted nothing more for me than for me to live and be sober in this program. And at 9 years sober, he was killed on the Del Mar freeway by a drunk driver. But I know that when he was in this program, and he's in the big meeting in the sky now, he was an active giving man in this program, active member of AA. But I stayed in that relationship, and you know, I finally got the courage to walk away. What happened for me was I got in a car accident I changed my sobriety date, and I started over, by the way. And around 2 years sober, I got in a car accident. And my life had been pretty, pretty insane. And I got in a car accident. My father came to pick me up. My mother and father came to the hospital to pick me up. And I was able to mend my relationship with my mother and father after I got sober, which is so important here. Anything can be amended. My father came and took me home, and I was supposed to be watched for 24 hours. I had broken ribs and a concussion. And the man that I was still living with said, I'm going to take your car and go drink. And I said, no, you're not. And I knew that it was over. And it was over long before I actually said it, but I was still trying to hold on. I was just refusing to let go and let God. And I finally said it, and the police escorted him out. And 1 week later, this violent, crazy man that I chose to put in my life, that I had every responsibility for, that he was there, came through my living room window and beat up a friend of mine in the program. And that man had to have 10 or 9 stitches in his face. And my sponsor said, Linda, you didn't get sober to live like this. You're going to die. What a great epitaph. Sober in AA, and she died at the hands of the man who beat her to death. What is it going to take for you to know that we love you? Because I cannot live in here and play out there like I used to. Can't do it. And I thought, what more can happen to me? And on a Friday night, my father called me, and he said, Lenny, I love you. My dad called me Lenny. You can call me Lenny. And he said, I love you, and he wanted to know if I was okay. And I said, yeah, I'm okay. And he told me he loved me, and I said, I love you, and we hung up the phone. And the next morning at 7 o'clock, the phone rang, and it was my mother. She had just retired. They had been married 40 years. She said, Dad's having a heart attack, and I don't know what to do. And I told her, call the fire department. I'm on my way. And when I got over there, you know, on the way, it was one of those days where you just didn't think anybody should die. You know, because I had the illusion that when I got sober, life would be perfect. But it isn't about that. It's life on life terms. This teaches us how to live to live with our unsolved problems. And I prayed, God, please wrap your love around my mother and my father. And I got over there, and my father had died. And but all prayers are answered. The book says God comes to those who seek him, and I believe that with everything. Because if it weren't true, I would not be standing up here sober today. The hardest thing I have ever done, drunk or sober, was close my father's eyes and let go. And I took his hand and I said the Lord's Prayer and I thanked God for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to a meeting that morning because for the first time, it took what it took. I was surrendered. I was going to do anything to be with you. I went to a place called Group 3 and a woman shared and she asked for volunteers. I put my hand up. And I said, my dad died this morning. I'm afraid. I said, I got to know God is. And you did for me that day what you had been doing ever since I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous and never recognized it. You got on each side of me and you held me up and you walked me through it. And you said, don't drink. It's going to be all right. And if you're new, I want to, and if you're not new, I want to share with you. It's 7 years this month since my father died. And he's still dead. And with that, I mean that, you know, if there's not a drink or a pill or a fix that could have brought him back. And what my sponsor told me, as hard as it may be for you to understand at this moment, God doesn't give you more than you can handle. He gives big crosses to big hosses and little crosses to little hosses. And he's not going to give you more than you can handle. And everything that God puts in your life is an experience for you to get out of yourself somewhere down the road in your journey to share with the other alcoholic who still suffers. Because 8 months later, a very close girlfriend of mine in the program, her father died. And I got to walk through it with her. We just got to keep coming back. But at the funeral, you know, people from the program came that didn't even know my dad. And I looked around and I went, not one person from the bars were there. I got to tell you that. But it was you. It was you there to hold me up. And at that meeting that day, a man shared how he stayed sober the day before his mother, the day before he was to take his year chip. His mother died of alcoholism, cirrhosis. And she had given him his first big book and helped him to get into AA. And he shared with me how he got through it. Now, I didn't go to a meeting that day looking for a man, and God knows I'd be in meetings looking for him, you know. And that was the man that I married 6 years ago, my husband. He, a few weeks later, saw me in the meeting, and he asked me how I was doing, and he asked me out to lunch, and I said no, and he asked me out to dinner, and I said no, and I was ready to be with someone sober, and I said, how about a meeting? I wanted to see where he was at. And he said, sure. And we went to dinner and to a meeting. And on the third date, he asked me to marry him. And I said, get back. I said, what's everyone? Oh, God. You know, I said that. So it just dawned on me what's everyone talking. I said, who's your sponsor anyway? He asked me every day for 6 months, and I said no. In fact, I said, you got to stop asking me. This is too much for me. Don't ask me anymore. And the first day he didn't ask me, I called him up. He didn't ask me today. So I finally said yes, and we had a beautiful wedding, and my sponsor stood up for me. Ken's father stood up for him. Our beautiful daughter was in the wedding, and our son, and lots of people. I think I had 5 or 6 bridesmaids. I wanted them all up there, you know. So many people had been through so much stuff with me, and it was wonderful. And right before we got married, Ken said, see, my husband is a cowboy, kind of. Kind of a farmer cowboy. And he said, you got to move to Dixon. And I always say, Dixon is where the men are men and the sheep are nervous. Ken said, honey, sheep aren't bad. No. I got to Dixon and I said, I can't live here. He says, we got a meeting once a week. I said, you don't have a mall. I need a mall. Where do you stop? He brought me eggs when we were dating, and I, you know, I said, my God, the least you could have done was wash the dirt off of us. He said, honey, that's not dirt. I said, oh, God, get away. He brought me a roasting chicken. and all wrapped up, and one time he brought me a liver, like it was still like throbbing or something. I said, oh, God, you know, I was like, oh, and when he moved me to Dixon, he came in this like, I don't know what it was. It was this big trailer and it had hay sticking out of it. And I said, what is this, a moving van? And everybody said, she'll never make it. This poor woman is just going to die in Dixon. And I hated it. And I learned a whole bunch of new words like can't and ain't and yep and nope. And yeah, how to slap my suspension. And then the third day I was there, we got overrun by crickets. Oh, my God. And he says, no problem. They're the locust family. But they won't do any damage. And finally, they just invaded our house. It was just, and I was crying, calling my sponsor. And I'm going to die. I'm going to be eaten by these crickets. I won't get to celebrate my third birthday. And so Ken came home with the dustbuster. Typical alcoholic solution, you know. So I call my sponsor, and in between crying, she'd try to say, I'm going to go, vroom, vroom, wait, vroom, vroom. it was hilarious. It was pretty awful at the time, actually, but I told my sponsor, I said, Dixon has nothing to offer me, because I was very involved in Sacramento. And she told me what she told me in the beginning. Why don't you live in Dixon with the idea of what you can give, not what you can get? Because this is a give program. And she helped get me back to what I needed to do. She said, why don't you get a job? They had a job ad in the paper, and I told Ken they'd never give that to me, and I went down there, and guess what? I applied. She said, just show up, and I applied. And all those years, that the things that I had done, you know, the impossibilities, I thought, they don't give careers to people like me. They don't let me do the kind of work that I would really love to do. And my history of being pretty crazy and calling my own ambulance and all of that. So they'll never hire me. And I went down and I applied, and they called me back and said, we want to talk to you. And my head said, oh, no, they found something out about me. And I went back and they said, we want you to come before an oral board. And I showed up and I told the truth. They asked me the most important thing in my life, and I said, I'm sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got hired by the Dixon Police Department as a 911 emergency dispatcher. Well, I've called it long enough. I kind of knew it. God is, if you're new. God is. He really is. I went to work for them, and the first time I sat down at the radio, they trained me, and I sat down at the radio, and 911 rang, and I said, 911 emergency, and someone said, there's a car accident, and I said, okay, thank you, and I hung up the phone. And, oh, God, I gotta do that. But, my supervisor said, well, what do you have? I said, a car accident. She goes, well, where's it at? I go, I don't know, but I'm sure they'll call back. And they did, and it was non-injury. And one night I had to search a female prisoner. We arrested her for being an unwanted guest at his house. And there she was at 3 a.m. in her see-through nighty top and Levi's, which is what we all wear when we're trying to get into his house at 3 a.m. I identified. She was drunk. But what I found, you know, was she was me. She was me. And as she stood there handcuffed with all of her dignity removed, whatever she had left, and her face running, her mascara and crying, and her nose running all over herself and drooling all over herself, drunk out of her mind, and she said, and I had to search her, and she said, why? Why am I here? And I thought, but for the grace of God go I in the steps of this program in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because you see, I am that woman. I am that woman. And what separates me from that woman is Alcoholics Anonymous, the steps of this program, and my God as I understand him. The loving God you have walked me to through the steps of this program. I learned a lot through that job. I left there last January. I worked for them for 5 years. It was a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing for me. I went through the Reserve Police Officer Academy. And I want to tell you, I didn't have to sleep with anybody to get that job. It was amazing. You know, the things you have taught me. And I went through the Reserve Police Officer Academy. It was mostly men. I hit myself in the face with a shotgun on the day shoot, and they said, she won't be back. But we got God in our corner because we go to Him. And I drove around the country that night for 20 minutes at CHP Academy. I got out to the CHP Academy, got out on the range, and if I didn't qualify, I couldn't be a reserve police officer. And I prayed. I said, God, help me shoot this target. I don't want a bullseye. Before, I would have asked for perfection. And I prayed, and I sat out there, and I prayed, and I qualified, and I didn't beat myself up in the face again with the gun. And the range master came over to me, and he said, you know, I've been watching you. And I thought, oh, here it comes. He says, back when I drove up, all this money changed hands between the guys, because they didn't think I'd come back. But he said, I've been watching you, and he said, you know, I don't know who you were talking to out there, but it sure did work. I got sick. I got pretty sick a couple years ago. I became very ill and was diagnosed as having another disease besides my alcoholism, and it was pretty tough for me. 2 months after they diagnosed me with that, my family and I were on vacation, and my right lung spontaneously collapsed. I ended up, I was on my way to be with Goofy in Disneyland. Well, not you, but the real Goofy. He's kind of goofy anyway, though. I like him, Goofy. Anyway, and I ended up, got up one morning and things were fine, and I ended up in Mercy Hospital in Bakersfield in intensive care for 8 days. And I kind of didn't want to be in the hospital, but I remember laying on the table the agoraphobic hypochondriac that I used to be when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. They gave me Demerol, and I bottomed out, and I almost died. I told them I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, but they had to cut me open while I was awake and put a tube inside my chest, and they needed to give me something so that I wouldn't go into shock, I guess. It almost killed me because I was so sober. But I remember laying there going, thy will be done, thy will be done. Because my sponsor told me when I came to you that God loved me absolutely, that I was His kid, and He would never let go of me. And if you're new, embrace that. Embrace this program with everything you've got, because it's true. We are His kid. The first two words of the Lord's Prayer says it. Our Father, we're His kids. He loves us absolutely. They moved me from the gurney into the bed in intensive care, and the lady said, are you allergic? The nurse said, are you allergic to anything? And I said, yeah, don't give me any Demerol. And I said, and alcohol. And she said, oh, well, how long have you been allergic to alcohol? And at that time I said, well, yeah, you're right, here it comes. Anyway, she was sober 4.5 years in the program. The cleaning lady, this Indian woman, saw my big book on the nightstand as she was pushing the dust mop around my room the next day, and she said, I'm going to have 3 years coming up. And all the people in the Bakersfield Fellowship, they were so wonderful. You're so good to me. We're so good to each other here. Because I'm sure if Ken had called the local bar and said, hey, my wife and I were on our way to Disneyland and our one collapse, could you send a few people over to keep her company? I'd probably still be waiting. But the people from Bakersfield Fellowship, people I didn't know but that I knew, came and held me up and walked us through it. And their love helped heal me to get me out of there. And I haven't let it stop my life. They told me it could happen to me again, but I'm out there. I want to live, you know. I want to live today. I want to be with you. I want to experience it. A year ago, our 16-year-old son got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. The little boy that I left on the corner, who's been coming to meetings since he was 6 1/2 with his mother, now comes into meetings and sits down as an alcoholic. And I've watched you give to him what you've given to me since the day I got to you. And I love you for that, for staying to be here for him. God, thank you for that. Last April, before I want to share one other thing with you. My husband decided to run for public office. And this is a man who, when I was working for the police department, one day there was this big city picnic or something. I said, oh, I want to introduce you to the chief of police. Got Ken over, and he says, oh, no, we've met lots of times. And at a time when Ken, you know, 10 years ago, Ken couldn't have been whatever in Dixon, couldn't have been the dog catcher, which is a good job, really. But 3 years ago, he ran for city council, and he lost. And everybody said to us, gee, that's too bad. And Ken and I thought, you don't know, it's a victory for us. to just get out there and experience life on life's terms. But 2 years ago, we tried again. You see, the success is in the trying. And he, not only did he win, he got the most votes. So for hating Dixon so much, now my husband's a councilman, and he's going to run for mayor, and I'm going to be the first lady of Dixon! You can all come to his inauguration. They ain't seen nothing yet. The last thing that I want to share with you is my life is good today. And it doesn't mean that I don't have problems, but I have you and the book and the steps and the new people and the people that I work with and sponsor. And I just make myself available to Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety is first day. It's before my husband. It's before everything. Last year when I went back east on the plane, I wrote an inventory because I needed to do one. I had some amends to make from wreckage and sobriety. And I decided when I came back east from that conference, I called my sponsor. And I said, you know, I'd like to name my son. She said, well, Eddie has a name. And I said, no, I'd like to name my son that died 19 years ago. And she said, sweetie, you go right ahead. And I don't know that I can ever talk about this without crying, but it's such a joy for me. And I went to a meeting and I talked about it, and I named him Alex Edward. And he didn't laugh at me. I thought you would say, well, that's stupid or silly. You shouldn't do that. But you didn't say that at all. He said, Linda will walk through it with you. It's okay. You can name him. Such freedom we have here inside. And in April, my sponsor said, why don't you do everything? Why don't you do what you couldn't do for him back then? Because you're not the same person anymore, Linda. So I invited a bunch of really close friends to come to our home. The city manager of Dixon, who happens to be a minister, who's a wonderful man. You see, wherever we are, people get put into our lives because God is where we are. It's an inside job. It's not about where we live. It's about how we live from inside out. And about 30 friends from AA came, and we had the service for Alex Edward that I never had 19 years ago. And for 19 years, all I could picture was a crazy, sick, hysterical, alcoholic woman in the corner of the room in the hospital in the dark giving birth to her baby son. And now when I think of Alex, I think of that day on my patio, this beautiful spring day, where my loving friends in AA came and helped me let go of my little boy. I thank you so much. I realize now that it's probably one of the biggest amends I will ever make. You see, anything can be amended, anything. And the next big amends is the way that I live today with my son and my husband in my family, because the book says that's really where we need to start, is within our family, that giving rather than getting should be the guiding principle. I can come to meetings and tell you a whole lot of stuff, but I got to go home and practice it and live it with my family, too. What you acknowledged to me was that my son mattered, and that even as that degraded alcoholic back then, my little boy had a soul, and he was a child of God, and he mattered, and I thank you for giving that gift to me. I am forever grateful to you, and I can never repay what AA has given to me, but I sure can try one day at a time. If you're sober, the miracle has already happened. Keep coming back. The impossibilities take just a little bit longer. Thank you for letting me share.